I think that's where we got a lot of positive feedback was exactly that, which is, listen, there are lots of great ideas out there. And we get a lot of people who come in and think that they know, you know, the answers to everything. And I love that you guys were really upfront about, hey, we don't know the answers to everything, but we're open about that. And it's more important that we are on the right track, that we're open to feedback, open to learning, open to testing, and then we'll quickly move and iterate to find the right path.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. I once heard some great business advice. See if you can fail your way to success. I totally related to it as an entrepreneur, as I've always learned best by making mistakes and then using those lessons to help build my business. Just repeating the phrase to myself, see if you can fail your way to success, alleviated the actual pressure of failing. I look at my mistakes as growth opportunities, and trust me, with my businesses, there have been lots of growth opportunities. Seasoned entrepreneurs understand that in starting a business, nothing really ever goes exactly to plan. There will be challenges and problems along the way, and if they don't stop you, they will most likely end up proving to be building blocks for your business. Daniela Jakubowski, the co-founder of Bubble Bar, the go-to online retailer for on-trend jewelry, seemed to understand early on that failures she had in her business were just part of the necessary process needed to eventually find success. As you just heard her say in her meetings meant to woo investors, where you basically want to tell them how great you are, she instead outlined the key mistakes she had made with her business. She was so confident in her methods that she let her potential investors know that she had made lots of errors. But each time she told them, she ended up learning something new and something knowledgeable that helped her build Bubble Bar. She didn't hide her mistakes or get down on herself or even try and pretend that everything had gone as expected. She was honest and she let potential investors know that mistakes help grow her business. She built Bubble Bar into a major fashion accessories business by failing her way to success, figuring out the right answers by making the wrong decisions. Even today, when she launches new jewelry products, it's a continual process of testing, failing, learning, and growing. In our conversation, I tried to find out Daniela's mindset and how she could just brush off failures that would cripple many other would-be entrepreneurs. So many people never recover from being thrown down, but Daniela, she actually thrives on it. Now let's get into my conversation with Daniela. I visited her at her office in the Flatiron District in New York City on a beautiful summer morning. We got to sit down and talk in a little conference room that once actually acted as the main shipping room for Bubble Bar back in its early days. So I began by asking Daniela about those early days and about some of the challenges she faced back then.
So when we originally formulated the idea, it was really based on our needs as two people who loved the category and loved to shop for accessories and fashion jewelry. And we had basically built out a whole hypothesis around what it would look like, what it would feel like, what the product would be, what the shopping experience would be. And we had an idea for ultimately what we wanted the brand and the company to be, but there are all of these tiny little decisions that ultimately make up what you bring to market. And we were fortunate that we came up with the idea before our second year of business school. So we were able to use our second year of business school to just do a ton of consumer testing and learning. So we wrote down all of our hypotheses around how folks would want to shop the category, what kind of product they'd want to buy, how they'd want to buy it, what that shopping experience would look like. And then we just conducted tons and tons and tons of focus groups to gather real-time information and feedback from people, which was really critical in those early stages, because I think you really don't know what you don't know. And I think a lot of us tend to put ideas together with blinders on a little bit and really focused on our own needs and what we think as consumers. And I think getting some of those other pieces of feedback really early was critical in doing a couple of things for us. I think one was helping us guide ourselves towards what was maybe not the final answer, but a closer version of it. And I think it also helped us get comfortable with this idea that we should always be testing and learning. learning. And we should always be asking the market and tapping the market for feedback and not be afraid to put something out that's not going to be the absolute final version. Because I think now 9 years in, I can definitely say, I don't know that the final version exists.
Right. And now you're 9 years in, right? And the business has become successful and you guys are doing really well. But take me back, because I understand you and your partner, Amy, were working initially in investment banking, pretty miserable, long hours, and you guys really bonded. You would go for these walks, which turned into like shopping sprees or what's the, I'm sure you spent a lot of money, or you didn't spend a lot of money.
We did.
Okay, you did that too. All right, I figured. So you're making a lot of money, hopefully investment banking, but you're spending it all and you guys are miserable. And how does this idea for Bauble Bar, how does it come to fruition?
Yeah. So Amy and I had met working in investment banking together. We were in two different groups and working really long hours, but learning a tremendous amount. I think what we've been able to take from our investment banking career and apply to what we do now has been extraordinary and extremely valuable. We both worked in investment banking and private equity and then went to business school. And we had the idea for Bauble Bar while we were in business school. So when we were in banking, that's exactly right. We would, you know, when you're an analyst, you're like waiting for pitch book comments until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And you're like, why am I here? What do I do with my time?
Right.
And Amy and I would walk to Saks Fifth Avenue, which was a couple blocks away. Mm-hmm. And we'd go to the shoe floor.
Sounds very dangerous.
It was so dangerous. Yes. And we'd blow it all there, you know, to be totally honest. I was like, well, if I'm not going to leave the office, at least my feet can look pretty. So that was kind of, you know, what had started it. And we were shopping for shoes. And we just started having a very organic conversation around how we spent our money. You know, at the time we were working in finance, we had very healthy salaries. We were both single, had no children. So you don't know what it's like to pay for.
No need to save. You can go spend on what you want.
Yeah, it's like saving. What's that for?
You know,
I think when you don't have kids, you just don't think that way.
Absolutely.
So we were, you know, spending it really on, at the time, shoes and bags and clothing. And we talked about how, as customers, we wouldn't hesitate to spend a substantial amount of money on a single pair of shoes or on a single handbag.
Right.
But we would never go down to the first floor and spend, you know, $150 to $200 on a great statement necklace or a really cool pair of earrings. And I think that for us, that sparked that first kind of aha moment, which was, well, we have all of this discretionary income. We're currently spending this discretionary income on other ancillary product. We love this particular product. Why don't we buy more of it? Why aren't we finding more of it that really suits our needs and tastes and preferences?
And when you looked at that and saw that, at that point, is that the aha moment? Or was it more like, hey, this is something interesting, and then it kind of festers? And because at that point, then you both decide, you don't start the business then, right? Because this is, you guys,
we're still in school.
You're still in school right now. So how does that then come about? Or as you said, this is when you kind of have this big opportunity to do all the research and to look if the business is rational because you're in school.
Yeah.
So you put all your time into it at that point?
That's exactly
that
right. And I think what's interesting is a lot of people always ask, what was the moment that you felt this? What was the moment that this happened? And when I look back, I don't necessarily think that there were these seminal moments where it just felt so clear and sure. I think that there were smaller moments that when you add them together, they start to make the uncertainty feel less scary or less likely or less
you
like
gain
something.
A little confidence that this is when we're going along the right path.
That's exactly right.
Maybe we want to try this. So you guys, okay, so now you put the concept, you have this concept, you kind of test it out to some degree because you're still in business school.
Mm-hmm.
So then at that point, what happens with business school? Is what, 2 years?
So we had had the idea after our first year.
Okay.
So we had 1 year of business school left, and we really used that second year as much as we humanly possibly could.
So smart.
So we, you know, fortunately in your second year, you were able to use field studies for class credit. So what we basically did is we lined up as many field studies as we could feasibly get credit for, and really tried to use the time that we would have dedicated towards attending class and doing homework for that class to just doing as much diligence on the business as possible.
Right. And this is Harvard Business School. So I assume you have a lot of great professors and other students.
Phenomenal.
Who you probably gained. Did you gain a lot of insight from them?
Huge. I think enough can't be said for being surrounded by 1,000 peers who are so willing to help, so excited to help you dig in, and who have this incredibly diverse array of backgrounds and experiences.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I can think now to some of my closest friends whose backgrounds were in very traditional marketing roles, who were able to sit with us and just start to give us, you know, this is how you would approach X, Y, and Z.
Yeah,
because I think that finance and banking gave us a really nice, well-rounded background, but obviously we didn't have functional expertise in a lot of these different areas.
Right, which is great because you can call on, I mean, obviously at HBS, there's people who've been working for a while, come from all industries. So you guys, you know, this is your idea and you start sharing it with classmates and others, and this is your project. What's the feedback?
So the feedback generally was really positive and really helpful. I think what was really exciting to see is that a lot of our peers were so excited for us and wanted to be helpful and help guide us in the right direction. So in the beginning, I think one of the first things we wanted to do was get a better understanding for what customers of the product were actually looking for. So we did a lot of focus groups that were focused explicitly on product itself, where we would buy product from wholesalers and retailers and other folks that were out there and just put a big range in front of people and ask them for their shopping preferences. You know, how are you buying this product? How do you think about buying different styles within the category? Do you buy multiples at once? Do you buy one at a time? Do you have lots of different taste preferences across styles? I think we really were trying to build a bit more of a profile around how people were shopping the category. And then we also wanted people's personal preferences for how they were shopping online. You know, at that time, we were launching online first. We had always had plans to have broader distribution, but at least to begin, we were doing it online. And we wanted to hear from people, what are the online experiences you like? What are the online experiences you don't like? You know, as customers, what are some of those things that you consider table stakes? And then the other thing we really wanted to do to get comfortable launching is we really felt that we needed to painstakingly map out exactly what the current industry looked like. Who are the players? How do they interact? Who does what? Who do we need to know? And we were able to spend a lot of time just kind of getting scrappy and running at things and piecing it together.
Well, it's like you have this whole year really to do all this research where you haven't raised any money, you don't have investors breathing down your neck, but you have this opportunity to really figure out this business. And you find that, I guess, a lot of your classmates are super interested. They see a great idea, great opportunity. Knowing from what you guys are selling as well, it looks like that the ages, the classmates, the people who, you know, are going to be your customers are the same age as, let's say, some of the students. So I'm sure you have this perfect target demo. But one thing you guys don't have, you don't have any experience in, I assume, fashion or jewelry. You're coming from investment banking. How did that play into this?
Yeah. So I think that it's funny. That's a question we get a lot. And I actually think it was a huge help because we were avid consumers of the product. And we were surrounded by avid consumers of the product. And that was enough, at least in the beginning, before we really hired up a team of folks who have experience in all of those areas to help guide us towards what people were looking for in the category in terms of their style preferences and what product got them excited. I think where it really helped us was it forced us to question everything. And I think that if we had really grown up in the industry and really had this preconceived idea for, well, this is how you merchandise, this is how you design, this is how you buy product, this is how you market.
It could kill your energy and creativity. And I've seen it, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that and asking the question. So many times people who disrupt or come in and build big businesses in certain industries, you know, a lot of times they don't have that experience. And it sounds like in this case, it enabled you and your partner to really come in there. And I mean, you obviously had experience from going on your shopping trips and realized what you needed, and you were the perfect target market.
Yeah.
So you had that. And I think that really helped. So coming out of school, you put this year in, and how does that, what happens? Like you graduate and then are you like, oh, shit, like we have to go out there now and like, this is for real? What happens?
So it's funny. That was probably the most, I think, interesting time when we were first getting started. So we had, you know, done all this research at school. which was hugely helpful. But at the end of the day, when you're not voting with your wallet, you're just voting on checking on a piece of paper, it's not as real as when you're asking someone to vote by like actually giving you their hard-earned money to purchase your product.
Absolutely.
And we recognize that was sort of the next frontier and the next step, which was we really have to see if people will vote with their wallets for this product. So towards the end of our second year, Amy and I actually self-invested to get a beta site up.
Okay.
And we stood a closed beta site up right after we graduated. So we graduated school in the summer of 2010, and immediately the next day, I think, like packaged up a U-Haul, drove back to New York, which is where we had lived before
and
we
guys
went to school.
So our listeners know, like, you guys are best friends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we've been best friends for well over a decade.
Which is super unusual. We'll get to that because I can imagine, like, working with friends is, like, one of my, like, no-nos. And, like, I've had instances hiring friends, and sometimes actually it's worked out, but partners and running a business and being best friends,
yeah,
you know, that's a whole other
totally,
story.
Totally.
But going back to the business at that point, you pack up the U-Haul.
Yeah.
Now you put up a beta site. So how much funding do you guys have to like throw into this at that point?
Not a crazy amount, but mm-hmm. truthfully, coming out of business school and having just given whatever I had to
like
business
you're in debt.
School and you're thoroughly in debt and you're about to like not pay yourself a salary on top of it. Definitely like it hurts. But I will tell you, I think when we were going out and fundraising for our first round of outside capital, there were two things that we consistently got extremely positive feedback from across the board from every single person we met with. One was that we believed in the idea enough to put some capital in. And even though
that
it was
you guys personally
exactly,
believed in the idea enough
exactly.
where you kind of
put
all
own,
your money into it.
Yeah, we put
it,
our money
right,
where our mouth
big.
Was. And it wasn't a crazy number. You know, we didn't fund millions of dollars into the business. You
right.
know, we each put, you know, five figures in and what we
real.
Felt like we could, but it was real. It was enough to have real skin in the game. And then I think the other thing people consistently called out is we had a slide in our first deck that said what we thought, what we tested, and then what we learned and how we were wrong and what we're going to do about it moving forward.
I love it. So you admitted that, hey, this is what we thought.
Yeah.
We tested. It didn't work.
Nope.
But this is how we're moving forward.
And how we're moving forward.
Which is such a lesson because for some people who think, you know, entrepreneurs and success just, you talked about earlier, is that vision and this is what it's going to be. Goes through so many iterations and mm-hmm. so many changes. And that's why I hear so many investors say they bet on the entrepreneur, not necessarily the idea, but the entrepreneur. And it sounds like in this case, they were betting on you guys.
You know, I think
with
so.
With a good idea.
Yeah. I think that's where we got a lot of positive feedback was exactly that, which is, listen, there are lots of great ideas out there. And we get a lot of people who come in and think that they know, you know, the answers to everything. And I love that you guys were really upfront about, hey, we don't know the answers to everything, but we're open about that. And it's more important that we are on the right track, that we're open to feedback, open to learning, open to testing, and then we'll quickly move and iterate to find the right path.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. Average 8 hours of sleep per night? Check. Eat a quality plant-based diet? Check. Exercise 4 more times per week? Check. Basically, you're doing everything right to ensure you live a long life. Isn't it time you be financially rewarded for your commitment to a healthy lifestyle? Introducing Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates for people like you on their life insurance. If you're a runner or a cyclist or you're into CrossFit or any other type of athlete, a committed weekend warrior, if you're a vegetarian or vegan, then you deserve to be rewarded for your hard work with more affordable life insurance rates. Health IQ can save you up to 41% because physically active people have significantly lower risk for heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And Health IQ is not just a lead generator. They take the customer through the entire process of applying, and the policy is underwritten by one of our top insurance partners. And these savings are exclusive to Health IQ. You won't find them anywhere else, and you must qualify to get a special rate. To see if you qualify, go to healthiq.com/HSH to take the proprietary Health IQ quiz. Depending upon your score, as well as other related qualifying factors, you can save up to 41% on your life insurance premiums compared to other providers. Again, that's healthiq.com/HSH to let them know we sent you and start the process with the Health IQ quiz. There's no commitment, and you'll learn even more about potential opportunities to be rewarded for your commitment to living healthy. One more time, that's healthiq.com/HSH. And our next sponsor.
When you own a business, having people you can trust makes all the difference. The same goes for your bank. With U.S. Bank, you work closely with dedicated business bankers who get to know you and your business. And with their years of experience and financial expertise, you can trust you'll get valuable solutions for your business. We all need people we can trust and ask for guidance. And with U.S. Bank, you're never on your own. Schedule an appointment with the business banker at usbank.com/book. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And we're back. So this stage, you guys put up a beta site,
yep.
Right? So take me through that process. Like, what are you feeling at that time? Because I imagine, like you said, school's over and like, this is real. You just dumped all your savings yep. into there. Like, what are you feeling? And take me back what it felt like those first 6 months or a year. Because I assume you didn't, did you go raise money right away?
So not too long after. So we graduated in summer. We moved to New York. We had been working on the beta site for a couple of months prior. So we knew that we were going to be launching the beta shortly after graduation. We launched it that summer. We had small shared space in New York. It wasn't one of the like new nice shared spaces that exist.
Because WeWork was just starting probably.
Yeah, it didn't really exist. This was 2010. We were literally in like a cage.
Yeah.
And my parents sent us an orchid as like a housewarming that died in a week. And I was like, this is what happens when you have no direct sunlight. Like we shouldn't be here.
It's so crazy to think back, and it's only been, let's say, 9 or 10 years.
Yeah, it hasn't been so crazy long.
Those old workplaces were like it just was so the opposite of what's happened in this experience. Financial economy and what's going on now, what people really want, that it's
crazy.
So
I remember the first time I walked into a WeWork, I was like, oh my God, you guys are so spoiled. I wish you had seen like the cardboard box that I worked out of for like some period of time.
It was crazy.
But it was fun. You know, it was ours. It was our space.
And it was your new business. So you guys move into one of these places.
Yeah.
You launch the business.
We launch our site. And it was, you know, it was crazy in the early days. I mean, we did absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. I mean, we were packing boxes, putting them in giant garbage sacks like Santa Claus and like walking to the USPS to like drop them off. You do everything in the early days.
And the business is basically you guys are coming up with, and correct me if I'm wrong, different types of lots of different jewelry items that are accessible to different demographics, not low cost, but they're good quality product, but the cost is within reason.
Exactly.
And this is the business that you guys launched.
And I think what we realized when we started is this is a category that so many people love to shop, but a lot of people offer nominally low value, but they don't offer relatively good value. So you had a lot of people offering great quality, well-designed product in that $150 to $200 space, which given how people like to use and wear this product, you use it to change your outfit, to experiment with trend, to have fun with what you're wearing. It's conspicuous and obvious. It's not like a pair of shoes where you're going to wear them every single day, so that cost per wear goes down. So we found that people, regardless of their ability to pay, really had a bit of a threshold for what they wanted to spend per item because they wanted more. You know, this is a fun,
trend
forward product.
My wife was not
product.
Part of that research group. I will tell you that because she definitely loves jewelry. And like, even now I see with, they go to a lot of these different groups of people, individuals who sell jewelry. And it's so, it's shocking to me how expensive it is. And like, whenever I bring it up, like, why are you spending like whatever amount on this like little ring or bracelet? She's always like, you know that feeling you get when your jet season tickets arrive and you open the box and I don't know how you spend that much money on all of that. That's why I spend that money. But it seems like what you guys were doing is you were giving that experience or that feeling to all different people in all different socioeconomic categories who can now afford to buy these items and not feel bad of buying it and then, you know, letting it sit for a little and buying something else.
Yeah.
And it seems like that was the idea that caught on.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely, I think we really nailed the combination of design, fashion, and quality combined with price points that felt, you know, really differentiated in the marketplace and that people were really excited to come shop with us.
Right.
I think we also really did a nice job offering a broad assortment and range of product. So for us, I think one of the big takeaways that we had from a lot of our consumer testing was people told us that in this category, they felt that they had to go to 10, 12, 15 different places to really find the range of accessories right. that they wanted. We found that this was really a category where customers were a lot more experimental with their fashion choices versus apparel, where people tend to have a bit more of a style that they right. stick to. And again, if you're going to cover your body in it, it's more of a commitment.
Right.
Versus if it's a necklace or a bracelet or an add-on.
Give it a shot one night.
Yeah. That's what we found response. Is people felt comfortable being a little bit more experimental with their fashion choices in accessories. But a lot of the retailers had more narrow or specific assortments. So I think that was something else that we really focused on pretty early on was how do we offer the right range and mix of assortment so that we really get that person who comes in who wants maybe something that's a bit more edgy, but also wants something a bit more minimalist and might also be looking for something that's super colorful, bright, crazy, eclectic statement. And we right. kind of have it all.
Now, how big, because I think back to your timing, 2010, 11, 12.
Yeah.
And I think of traditionally how people shopped. And at this point, social media, especially Instagram and other kind of social networks are becoming a lot bigger and more important for people who are shopping. How big a role did social play for you? How big a role does it play today?
Yeah. So it's always played a massive role for us. I think, especially in those early days, you know, when it was, again, me and Amy in a cage, as we've now established.
Right.
We didn't really have money to compete on these, you know, we didn't have like a big ad budget.
Yeah, like you throw an ad in like Cosmopolitan or whatever magazine, it's like
it's
hundreds
crazy
of thousands
amounts
of dollars.
Money.
You'd blow back 20 years ago, you probably didn't have that money at that point, but you would blow a huge amount just to have
access.
Access
to
right.
people. And I think what's been really incredible over the past couple of years is social media really changed our ability to access people without throwing tons of money at it. So in those early days, it wasn't, I don't even think Facebook ads were yet a thing in 2010.
Right.
Or maybe they were, but it was so small scale and big brands weren't doing it and the costs were like, I mean, nothing.
Right.
But really what was getting traction on those platforms was just really understanding your community and your audience and knowing how to put forward content that would excite them, that would get shared, that felt authentic and genuine. Because back then, cutting through the clutter was pretty easy. There wasn't a lot of clutter. The other thing that really helped us was back at that time, what was starting to become bigger were bloggers who were wearing the product. And I think more importantly, really showing their audiences how to style the product and why they loved the product. So for us, what was a pretty key moment is when we were first starting, this fashion blog wrote an article about us. And we were like, oh, that's so crazy. We didn't even know this thing existed.
Right, like
let's reach out and say hi. So we reach out to this person and we say, thank you so much for writing this article about us. We'd love to meet you for a drink and just say hi and say thank you and learn a little bit more about what you do. So we meet her for a drink and it turns out she works in a very traditional marketing role at Coty in fragrance. And she's this blog on the side.
On the side, this
and
is her.
This is her like yeah. thing that she likes to do. And she said, I don't know if you guys are looking to hire anybody to run your social media, but I've always wanted to take my career in that direction. If you're looking to hire somebody, I'd love to talk to you about it. So long story short, we ended up hiring Grace on board. She was one of our first five hires. She ran our social media channels in terms of just posting content. So at this point, we weren't even talking about bloggers. She was just managing the content and the channel and putting us out there. And then we noticed that she was being invited to all of these events for bloggers. And she would wear, obviously, our product. And she would say, oh, I was at this so-and-so event, and so many people were complimenting my earrings. And finally, we were like, Grace, I think we found the answer. You need to start going to these events with bags of stuff. So we just started sending her with bags of product.
Great
and when
idea.
Somebody complimented her, she'd take it off and give it to them and put on something new. And we really built a very strong base of organic support through the blogger community, really through Grace. She gave us an opportunity to talk to a lot of people in that community one-on-one and have conversations about our product and the styles and the fashion and what we were excited about. And we were able to seed product in a very natural and organic way.
So you're getting this going, you know, you're doing obviously different types of marketing and you hire Grace. And when do you know, first off, like that, hey, the business is doing we're doing okay. Like, we've got something here. When did that moment come?
So truthfully, I think that actually happened a little bit before Grace, because one of the things Amy and I really spent a lot of time thinking about was, at what point do we want to try to raise external capital? Is that a path we want to go down? We had decided that we didn't feel comfortable extending employment offers to anybody until we had raised enough capital that we felt that, hey, we at least have a year and a half or some time. We
could pay their salaries. You didn't want to bring anyone in and then have to shut the doors.
Exactly. That was, you know, we felt that between the two of us, we'd been through a lot, and we knew that we were scrappy enough to figure out most things. So for us, I think the real moment came, you know, we had been running the beta site at this point for probably about 3 months.
Okay.
And we start looking at the data. And, you know, when we first started, you know, I think the first order was my mom. And then the second order was Amy's mom. And then the third order was my mom again. And it was like, hey, we're on to you guys. You know, we look at the data very regularly. You know, and it was sweet. We were really being supported by our friends and family.
Good reviews, I'm sure.
Yeah, everything. No, totally. My mom gave us at least 3 stars.
She better have.
But, you know, about 2-3 months in, we started pulling the data. And we also, at that time, had run it as a closed site. So you had to sign up, create an account to access the product.
So you had to put your email in. And
exactly.
Why'd you start it like that?
At that time, Guilt Group had launched, and everyone was talking about the excitement of the exclusivity. And it was funny, that was actually one of our learnings, was this whole closed site thing is actually more of a pain than it needs to be. And maybe we don't need to hamper conversion by making it so difficult
and
to shop with us.
It's so funny because I remember so many of those sites, and now I rarely come across a site where it's like, put your email in or you can't like view the site.
Totally. I think this was also at a time where email marketing was really like the bread and butter of organic digital marketing. And now I think that's really decreased in importance.
That's a good point.
It's not something that's such a critical thing for folks. But we did it for that. And I think we also did it because at that point it was still a beta site. We were using a completely different name for it. I mean, we really wanted to have a lot of control.
It wasn't Bobble Bar?
No.
What was the name?
So the name of it was 816.com,
okay.
Which Amy and I have the same birthday, which is
that's
August
so
16th.
Weird. All right.
Yeah. And
so
by the way,
birthday's
coming up. If you want to send something, feel free.
Of course.
Really
some
funny.
Bobble Bar gifts.
Phenomenal. That would be the best way to reward us, actually. But it was so funny because I remember when we were running the beta site, so many people told us, don't ever name companies with numbers. It's really hard for people to remember. And as proof of that, my father, who is Israeli and learns dates backwards, would always be like, what's the name of your site again? 618-168. And I was like, Abba, it's my birthday. If you cannot get the name of this website right, like, we've got some real problems afoot.
No one's going to be remembering this.
Come on. It's our birthday.
So that's another learning moment where
totally.
You said you went through, you change it.
Yeah, and we had never intended for 816 to be the business name, but, you know.
Just because it was in beta?
We knew that we wanted a name that wasn't necessarily going to carry forward. We knew that we wanted to take all of those learnings and really start fresh, and we had been doing tons of focus groups amongst, like, our friends for the final company name. But, you know, 2-3 months in, we're pulling the data, and we start to see that we don't recognize anyone who's placing orders anymore. I'm like,
that's like such a great moment.
Oh,
right?
It's so
like,
good.
I don't know this guy.
I was like, I don't know you, and I don't know you, and I don't know you, but you're shopping with us.
And now I know you, and I love you.
I think you're fantastic. Now I'm going to reach out and say thanks. And I think that was really exciting. And then we also noticed that there was some really strong repeat behavior amongst people that, again,
Did you even anticipate that? Did you think it was like one and done? And people,
you know,
would
we weren't sure. I think that we had hoped that people would shop seasonally because it's such a great product for really refreshing your wardrobe and playing with trend. So we thought people would maybe be purchasing it at that rough cadence. But I think we were really excited to see so many people who placed an order, and then it was so clear that they had received their order and come back and bought more.
And then how are you handling the fulfillment? Like the back end, like
so
that's got to be
painful.
Did
that ourselves. Again, we are some scrappy folks. So to this day, we have never in our life used a 3PL. We have always
a
third party pick, pack, ship facility.
Okay.
So a lot of companies will send their product to what is basically a third party warehouse that's responsible for fulfilling and shipping the orders.
That's great. So you guys do that all here.
Do it all in house. I think we always found that the flexibility that we had by doing pick, pack, and ship in-house really outweighed the benefits of sending it out to somebody else. And it certainly has been its own special learning moment, really getting that up and perfecting it. I mean, for a period of time, we actually had our warehouse in our headquarters in Manhattan.
Okay.
Like, most expensive warehouse facility.
Yeah, the amount you're paying
for a
warehouse.
Yeah.
But
our product's tiny. So in the early days,
right. You can store a lot.
We actually stored it in a room the size of the room we're sitting in right now.
Room here,
I mean, this is what, probably like 200
square feet,
something like that. So we had all of it in bins, in organized bins, in a 200 square foot room. And we had one person who every day would pick, pack, and ship. And USPS would come pick up our orders daily.
And you never changed that. So it's kind of like you guys learned that very early. This is the way we want to go. Have you considered changing that now?
We have our own warehouse that we operate ourselves.
Right, but you guys still operate it yourselves.
We still operate it ourselves.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so the business is going well. You guys are hustling. It's building up, raising money, and getting back to that. Did you always consider that? Was that something you knew you were going to go towards? How did it come about?
Yeah, so I think that's something we felt that we would want to do in order to have the capital to really kind of seed the company and be able to make some hires and buy some inventory and scale. I also think, given that we had both come from finance, that was probably the part of the business that felt a little bit more comfortable for us.
Right, like you're in investment banking, you went to Harvard Business School,
worked in private equity, used to looking at businesses.
Yes.
Like we felt like there was still a lot we needed to learn around venture capital and that part of the fundraising spectrum. But we felt like, you know, we know how to put a good presentation together. Actually, when we were raising our seed round, someone said to us in the middle, "I want you guys to know this is one of the best presentations I've ever seen. And if this company doesn't go anywhere, I really think you could make a business of this."
Putting these together.
Yeah. And
I wanted to send me that, because I can use that in my next venture.
Yeah. What I wanted to say was, we literally left investment banking to not put presentations together for a living. And there is no way that we are doing this as our future business.
Right.
But thank you for the compliment.
Yes, exactly. Because that's, I'm sure they see a lot of pitch decks.
Yeah. And it was really amazing to hear. And it was great to get that feedback, because I think it meant that we had really done a great job communicating, the vision and what we wanted to build and where we saw it going.
Yeah.
So that was really, it was really exciting to hear.
And raising money at this point, I mean, that's kind of one, you can get a lot of things wrong kind of along the way and change and then build your business and make mistakes. But raising money, depending upon the amount, of course, is one of those ones you're getting in bed with a partner. So someone you want to know how to work with, trust. And also, you know, at the same time, it's like you can't go back on that one and you can't change that. So how do you go out there, you're meeting with investors, potential investors. How do you decide on the right backer?
So I think for us, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, which is, once you take money from somebody, they're with your business forever. This needs to be somebody that you feel really great about. You need to feel really great about working with them for the long term.
They can be really annoying
if things
aren't good.
Yeah. And not only that, you know, I heard someone giving a talk once that basically said there are three kinds of investors. There are value add investors, there are value neutral investors, and then there are value detractors. And one of your biggest goals when you're raising money is, make sure you don't have bucket three. You can sometimes get bucket two that likes to sell itself as bucket one. And obviously bucket one usually properly self-identifies.
Yeah.
But you really don't want to find yourself opting for bucket three. And I think, again, given our backgrounds, we were really cautious about doing a lot of diligence. Not only calling, of course, the recommendations that once, you know, we had term sheets from folks, they provided references that we could call. And obviously, if you ask somebody for a reference, they're going to get you people who are going to give you glowing reviews of that person, right? That's what I would do if I were interviewing for a job.
Don't call references because it's such a waste.
Yeah,
of course.
It's not particularly helpful.
You're not putting someone down that you didn't talk to and like made sure they were
super happy.
Yes.
So I think what we found, and we were really fortunate to find this, is the entrepreneurial community we found to be really welcoming and really helpful. And we found that most people, if we just sent them a note and said, "I'm talking to so-and-so from XYZ firm, we're talking about maybe taking funding from them, I'd love to hear a little bit about your experience," most people will answer you back and are happy to pick up the phone or meet you for a coffee and give you their thoughts. And again, a lot of this information is really publicly available. You can easily pull up who's in anybody's portfolio, pick a couple, reach out, and ask them for their thoughts and opinions.
Yeah, it's a great point. So you guys, who comes in, and what was it? Was it hard to raise the money? Did you have a lot of options? And then who ends up backing you guys?
Yeah, so we were really fortunate that we had a few options we were choosing between in finalizing who was going to lead the round and then ultimately fill in the round. We ended up going with Teresa Gao, who at the time was a partner at Accel. Mm-hmm. And we were really excited to work with Teresa for a wide variety of reasons. One is when we met her and we started explaining the business opportunity, she just got it in 2 seconds. And we got to spend the rest of our meeting having a really juicy, exciting discussion about what we were going to build, how we were going to attack the problem, what that was going to look like.
It's interesting having, I interviewed Jenny Fleiss from Rent the Runway.
Yeah.
And she said when they went out pitching that Rent the Runway idea, it's all these like guys in their 60s and they had no idea what that experience was like. So it sounds like you were fortunate, at least initially, to have Teresa, who was like, I totally get this, because some dude who's like 60 years old sitting there is not going to understand.
Yeah, not in the same way.
In the same way.
You know, and I think that we were fortunate that we did meet with a number of male investors who did get it and were a bit more familiar with the space and ultimately did submit term sheets. But there was something about, you know, the way that Teresa really understood it a bit more fundamentally that was exciting to us. And the fact that she was a buyer and consumer of the end product was exciting to us. And then the other thing that made a big difference was at the time, we had actually moved out of the cage and we were now subletting space from our good friend Alexa Von Tobel, who was running LearnVest at the time, whose major investor was Teresa Gao from Accel Partners.
Interesting.
So we had spent the past month and a half watching Alexa's relationship with Teresa on a very close level because we sat in her office.
You got to see what she was about.
Exactly.
For a year. Kind of like,
there's no better diligence than that.
Sounds like you guys have a lot of these. You know, you're at business school for a year, you figure it out, you have this learning opportunity, and then you make smart decisions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think having really seen their relationship up close, I think it just felt like somebody that we, you know, felt was a really good fit for the business and for us. And that was a really great, trustworthy person and a really strong value-add investor.
So talk about your partnership with Amy Jan, and how you guys, because I think this is something I was pretty much blown away by when I was doing some research on you guys, that you guys are really, like, really best friends. Like, I think one of you guys was maid of honor at one of your weddings.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, it's for real. And I've always, when I've had partners, I've one business partner I've had for a long time and a couple different ventures. And like, we've been friends, but like, I always knew like I had a best friend or someone I could talk to that just to like talk about the partner or like not necessarily, but like, you know, just get out of the business. And it sounds like you guys have this great relationship that how does that go? Are there issues? Are there problems sometimes, I imagine?
I mean, there always are in every relationship. I think for us, what really helped is by the time we started Bauble Bar, we had been through a lot together. We met in a work context, which I think really helps.
Right.
We had traveled the world together, which, you know, you want to know how the other person's going to perform under pressure. Try flying to Southeast Asia and having no luggage for a week. And like, you'll learn real quick. you know, we had those experiences.
Yeah.
We knew how to disagree and still come to the table and not hate the other person.
Right.
You know, I think those are all really important experiences that you have to have if you're going to partner on something like starting and running a business together.
Yeah. And it seems like what you guys are each good at or want to focus on is really what the other one has no interest in.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think having complementary skill sets and having complementary areas where you can really support the other, that you trust the other to really kind of run with and keep you up to speed and up to date on. And I think ultimately it comes down to complementary skill sets, communication, and trust.
Yeah, and making sure, I assume, both of you have the same, you know, intensity and work ethic. And
absolutely.
There's no issues
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. And that we knew. I mean, I'd say that's one thing that was never even remotely a question, because we're both quite similar in that space. But I agree, it's a very important one.
So the business today, I mean, as we look, you guys are celebrating like 10 years or not? Or
we'll be coming up on 10 years.
Coming up
on
10.
Which is crazy.
Right.
It just
now, you didn't launch it
way.
On August 16th, did you?
We didn't. Okay. We didn't. But August 16th is a little bit of a celebration
office. I hope everyone here is bringing in, you know, some gifts and cakes and celebrating. But for the the business now celebrating its 10th year. Where are you guys and where are you going and what's kind of changed from those early days or first few years when it was just you and Amy grinding it out?
Yeah, I mean, so much has changed. You know, when we first started, we were a single brand selling direct to consumer. And now, today, we are multi-category, multi-brand, you know, multi-distribution point. So the business itself has evolved an extraordinary amount. You know, I think the one thing that's a constant, which keeps us excited and keeps us going, is we're always learning. We're always learning something different. We are always evolving the business, ourselves, our perspective on things. And I think that's what keeps you excited to just keep pushing forward.
Yeah, it seems like that's really been a theme within your adventure here, that you guys have continued to be open to learning and changing on the fly. And with that, you've really achieved this success that it seems like it's part of the culture now.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been fun and crazy and, you know, at the same time.
I could imagine. Yeah. So anything else that we didn't cover that you think might really be important for people listening who are out there? Because a lot of our listeners, you know, they want to take the plunge, right?
Yeah.
They want, and there's, I know for you and for other entrepreneurs, myself, there's a fear. And like you guys have said you've had that, right? And like, how'd you get over it? And like, what do you advise?
So, you know, in the beginning, we definitely there, especially if you've never done anything entrepreneurial or started something before, the uncertainty of what could happen is very real and very, very scary. It's funny because Amy and I now, when we look back, we say in retrospect, the decision to ultimately start the company and not pursue other full-time roles at the time felt like such a difficult decision. And now we realize should have been a super easy one. And I think that's because in facing the prospect of starting something, I think the real fear that happens is, well, what if the business fails? What if it doesn't work out? Then what do I do? What will I do for a job? What will I do for my career? And I think that we have to get comfortable with this idea that this stigma around fear or the stigma around failure is wrong.
Yeah.
Failing can be a very good thing as long as you learn from it and apply that learning towards what you do moving forward. I think that the failures, the disappointments, the things that don't happen according to plan, those are the moments for growth and change.
It's so important. And I heard a quote like fail your way to success. And I love it because that's what being an entrepreneur is all about and understanding like it's never going to go perfectly. It's never going to just be like all peaches and cream. And like they're going to be hard moments and it's learning from those moments and then having the ability to pick yourself up off the mat and keep going, I think that makes for successful entrepreneurs.
I totally agree.
Yeah. So we will wrap up. I do want to tell you, though, I actually knew about you guys a few years ago because one of my daughter's babysitters actually used to work for you guys.
Oh, my God. Who?
It's a girl by the name of Alana Enten.
Oh, my God. That's so crazy.
Alana was our babysitter before she moved out to
that's
San Francisco.
Bananas.
And we would always hear, and she'd come in with all these samples, and my girls would love. And then, of course, my wife became a customer, which I thank you
that's
very
amazing.
Much because
thank you.
She's buying, you know, from your guys' quality at a good price as opposed to quality at not so good price. But we knew about you guys, and
Grace, who I told you about?
Yes.
Alana was her first hire.
Alana was Grace's first hire. I love that.
Yep. And then Alana transitioned into Grace's role when Grace wanted to pursue her blog full time, which happened a couple of years in.
That's incredible. See, all these things we don't
small
know.
World.
Yeah, Alana.
That's so funny.
She's moved out to.
She's in Philadelphia now.
Well, now they moved again to San Francisco.
Oh, they're back in San Fran.
Yeah, so she's
so
in San Francisco, where you know she's from. But in any case, we would hear such great things about you guys,
and she
would tell us how great this company was.
Oh, thanks so much.
And yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, I'm like this sports guy, so I was kind of tuning out, but I've got two daughters and a wife, and like they were like, I remember she would come in and dump them on the kitchen table and like, look at this, and like, this is cool. And it was really cool. So
That's awesome.
So nice to get the chance to actually sit down and talk
with
you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks
that's
for being
awesome.
Up.
Thank you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning. And you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.